Well, in a few weeks, Jessica and I will be going up to Minnesota. Jessica's brother Aaron is getting married, and I'll be doing the wedding. And always going to Minnesota about this time of year reminds me of the first time I ever went up to Minnesota to meet Jessica's family. Went up there to Minnesota to be at the family cabin for a weekend on Horseshoe Lake, about 3 hours north of the metropolitan area in Minnesota. Oh, there's my wife. There she goes. And I'll never forget, about 5 or 6 years ago, Jessica and I went up to the cabin so that I could meet her family for the very first time. And I was wanting desperately in my head to make a favorable first impression with these folks who I didn't know but were eventually going to become, you know, part of my future family. And I thought, well, McGray, if you play your cards right and if you dazzle them and impress them, you will make an impression that will last forever. They would go up to Jessica, this is in my mind, they would go up to Jessica and say, "My, Jessica, what a catch you have found. What a wonderful fella you have found. Don't ever let this guy get away." Of course, I didn't think about it, but there was also equal possibility that they would pull Jessica aside and say, "Jessica, we have to have a talk." So on one fine summer day, July 4th weekend of 1994, Jessica and I went to that cabin on Horseshoe Lake to meet her family for the first time. Really, the entire family was there, her aunt, her uncle, her two cousins, her brother, her grandmother, and her dad. They were all there. And I met many of the family members when I got into the cabin and found out that Uncle Mike was in the back on the pier on the lake. And so I walked out to introduce myself to him for the first time. Now, Uncle Mike is the sort of fellow that you would see wearing dark specs and, you know, toting a piece in gangster movies. He was built like a bear. This guy was a wrestler. He was a football player, star athlete in high school, a pretty intimidating presence. But undaunted, I wanted to make a good impression. So I walked up to him and I stuck my hand out and said, "Hi, you must be Uncle Mike. I've heard some wonderful things about you." And Uncle Mike looked at me and said, "Oh, you're Jessica's boyfriend. You must be Steve." "No? But Gary." "No? But you must be John." Turns out this Uncle Mike had a wonderful practical joke streak in him. And probably the biggest mistake I ever made on that weekend, this weekend where I wanted to make such a great first impression, was that I attempted to water ski for the first time. I still have pictures of Jessica and I as she is trying to strap this life jacket on me. And you couldn't tell, but my fingers were a little bit trembling in the picture. And she was trying to fit my big size 13s into some narrow slats of wood that were supposedly trying to keep me up. Uncle Mike comes to me and he says, "McGray, I'm going to be driving the boat and I have just one piece of advice to give you. Whatever you do, don't let go of the rope." "Don't let go of the rope. Don't give up. Don't worry. The thrust of the boat will get you up on top of the water and eventually you'll pop to the surface. Don't let go of the rope." So he revved up the boat and off he went, and I looked there on the surface of the water, and there was that slack tow line that was teasing me, taunting me, showing me how easy it was to float on top of the water. Well, as the boat went off, I watched as that slack tow line came jolting to life, and then a couple moments later, I felt the pull. A very strong pull, I might add. And at that very moment, the only words that crossed my mind were, "Don't let go of the rope." And I continued to think that thought as I sunk straight to the bottom of the lake. "Don't let go of the rope," I continued to think for about 7 or 8 full seconds as I plunged through the depths of that lake, thinking, if I just hold on to the rope, Mike tells me that I'll pop to the surface. The only popping I felt was the skis off my feet, and watched as the skis themselves went up to the surface as if to say to me, "You know, McGray, we're skis, and we're going to go to the surface with or without you." Well, that was my first experience skiing. And I began to wonder throughout that time whether Mike's words were actually good skiing advice or another one of his wicked practical jokes, because he was in fact driving the boat as well. So we tried it several more times that afternoon, about five times in all. Sometimes I would start on the pier, sometimes I would start in the water, but every time I'd wind up in the same place with a big splash and then a dredge, 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 dredge the bottom of the lake. Felt like a garden plow being pulled through a garden of seaweed by a seditious ox. So much for making a good impression on the family for the first time, and I never actually did get to ski. And I left that event thinking, you know, if God really intended for people to float on top of the water, he would have given us pontoons instead of feet. Our story this morning is about a man who came to just that same conclusion, about a man named Peter and his effort to walk on the water. It's a story that we all know. We're familiar with this. We know the great dramatic aura that this story brings to us of suspense and intrigue, as you can hear the storm brewing on the outside, and you can feel the ship being tossed and turned, and you can sense the bravery and the act of courage that Peter has as he steps out onto the water for the first time, as well as that tragic bit of irony as he starts to sink right to the bottom. It's the stuff of Hollywood. It's a great story. And I suppose the temptation this morning is to encounter this story and go right to the good stuff, to the exciting stuff. But I don't want to do that just yet. If you will, journey with me a couple moments before this episode. I want to take a look at one event that sets this entire story up. It takes place on top of a mountain. Remember that in the story prior, Jesus had just finished undertaking a catered meal for 5,000 people. He had just done a miracle, taking a paltry sum of food and using it to feed the masses. It had been a long day of teaching and of feeding. And Jesus does a peculiar thing. Jesus asks the disciples to go on without him so that he can go to the mountaintop and pray. Why do you think Jesus did that? Why did Jesus choose this moment to be by himself? After all, he had just worked a miracle. He had the people right where he wanted them. His tummies were full. Their tummies were full and their ears were open, and he had them just where he wanted them. He could have told them anything and they would have listened. But instead, Jesus chose to withdraw from the people and be by himself. Why do you think that was? Why do you think it is that we need a break sometimes? Could it have been that Jesus was physically tired? It had, after all, been a very long day. Could it be that Jesus had a little bit of introvertedness in him and just decided he needed to be by himself to recharge just for a few moments? Or maybe he just needed to spend some time talking to God and debriefing the day's events. These are all valid reasons for taking a vacation or taking a day off or taking a sabbatical. We wouldn't blame Jesus at all if any of these were the reasons that he decided to step away. We all need to do that. But what was the reason that Jesus chose to withdraw and pray? I think Matthew has a clever way of showing us just those reasons. Because as Jesus is praying, he sees the rain starting to fall, and he feels the wind starting to whip, and hears the thunder starting to roll, for a great storm brews in the middle of his prayer and on long into the night. And throughout the scriptures, we see and we know the significance of the storm and the sea. The sea kind of has a character in the scriptures. Remember, it's the sea that buried Pharaoh's army. Remember, it's a great flood that destroyed all of creation except for Noah and a select few. And a storm-tossed boat ultimately resulted in Jonah's being tossed overboard and into the belly of a fish. There are two things in common whenever the sea is mentioned in the scriptures and the storm is mentioned in the scriptures. The first is the chaos of life is powerful. The sea is powerful. And the second thing is, it is indiscriminatory. The chaos of life, the storms of life, happen to the just and the unjust. They happen to the believing and the unbelieving, to the faithful and the wicked. And it was happening to the disciples in the Scriptures in this moment. And remember, all they were doing to get themselves in this position was following Jesus' orders. Jesus told them to go out into the middle of the boat, and look where it got them, in the middle of a storm. Perhaps this morning you were caught in a storm of yourself, of your own. Maybe your storm is a little one. Maybe it's just an annoying wind that keeps bugging you. Some of you, I imagine, are caught in the middle of a hurricane, a tornado, a tsunami. The storms of your life are great and they are powerful. But you need to know this. You need to know that the storms of life happen to everyone, not just to the unfaithful and not just to the wicked. And they don't happen for punishment. They don't happen for vengeance. They don't happen to correct you for anything that you have done wrong. And they don't happen to destroy you. The disciples were in the middle of the storm, and all they were doing was following the orders of Jesus. So we begin to see for just a moment why Jesus chose to be by himself for a moment and pray. Because as he was saying amen, he knew that his friends were in danger, and he saw the storms coming around them. You know the story as it happens. Jesus starts to walk, turning the water into a sidewalk, walking out to the boat in the middle of the night. And the disciples see Jesus for the first time, and they don't even know it's Jesus. They think it's a ghost. After all, there's lightning flashing all around them, and they're probably nauseous from the seasickness. They could be seeing anything. And they think that Jesus is in fact a ghost. Peter, in fact, has to find out for himself. He is unsure whether this is really Jesus or not, because he asks, "If it is really you, Jesus, command me to come out onto the water." And the voice of that ghost says, "Come." And Peter walks a few steps out onto the water, not sinking, not swimming, not treading water, but walking on top of the water, on the surface. He does to the water what so many of us want to do with our problems. He overcomes them. He walks on top of them. He is superior to them, and he was safe. But just for a brief moment, scriptures tell us that he lost his focus. He looked down, and he looked around. And he came to that same realization that Wile E. Coyote gets whenever he runs out of that canyon cliff and realizes that he's defying the law of gravity and holds up that sign that says, "Bye-bye," and starts plummeting into the chasm below. That's what happens to Peter when he loses his focus. Jesus is right there to pull him up. In fact, it is Jesus. And Jesus says, "Oh, Peter, you have little faith. Why did you doubt?" Jesus doesn't admonish Peter for being afraid. He doesn't admonish Peter for being overwhelmed by the wind. These are really just human responses. These are okay. Jesus understands that because he is fully human. And he doesn't ask Peter to stop being afraid or stop being human. But he does chastise him for one thing: for having doubt. For his lack of faith, for losing his focus, for losing his focus. You know that in the Greek, the word doubt actually means double-mindedness. It means trying to look in two different directions at once. In colloquial terms, it means trying to live on both sides of the fence at the same time. That's what it means to have doubt. And so Matthew tells us that the meaning of faith in this passage is to be single-mindedly focused on God, to continue looking ahead instead of down, and to believe that God is right there with you every step of the way. Maybe to give you strength, maybe to give you direction, but for whatever reason, to remind you that God is indeed there, and that whatever you do, don't let go of the rope, and don't give up. Peter has doubts in his mind from the moment he stepped out of the boat. And as Peter walked out on the water, he tried to focus on two things at the same time. He tried to focus on the one who had called him out there and the one who was with him, but he also tried to focus on the wind and the waves around him. And the moment he tried to think about two things at once, he started sinking. That's why Jesus prayed on the mountain, to get his focus right, to know that storms were coming and storms were going to happen. And if he didn't have his mind set, focused on one thing, that his mind would drift and he, in fact, might sink as well. Peter learned the lesson the hard way. You lose your focus and you lose your footing. I pray that that might be the lesson that we learn today. As we go out of this place and face the wind and the gale and the storms ourselves, all the problems that we face in our life, to remember that it's not our fault, that these things happen to the just and the unjust. And to remember that it's okay to be human in encountering these things, but it's not okay to be double-minded. That in order for us to walk with Jesus above our problems, we have to be singly focused on God in all that we do. So that might mean that you, in fact, do need to withdraw for a little while. You may need to take some time off to be by yourself. But do it more than just for recharging physically. Do it for more reasons than just getting away from people or your problems. Do it so that you can set your focus right, so that you can set your sights on the one who can save you and who is with you every step of the way. Take a spiritual sabbatical for yourselves, so that when the storms start brewing, you can start walking. And whatever you do, don't let go of the rope. In the name of the Creator, the Redeemer, and the Sustainer of us all.